Hello and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. This week we return to the big picture as one of the investment industry's most closely followed strategists, Peter Berezin at BCA, gives us his thoughts on the current economic conditions and where the best opportunities but also threats lie. And following Mark Mobius's more bullish claims last week on emerging markets, this week we get something quite different from Peter, and here is what he had to say on the prospects for the sector.
And when you have that much debt at a time when monetary policy is finally starting to become more restrictive in the US, it's a recipe for all sorts of turmoil in emerging markets.
So for more detail on that particularly EM bearish stance, but also thoughts on developed market equities, the dollar and bonds, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Guttridge, Head of Fund Research. And today we'll be looking at some more macroeconomic issues and a conversation. We're delighted to welcome Peter Berezin, the Chief Global Investment Strategist at BCA. And I have to say, I think of all the research we consume here at Brewin Dolphin, I think it's your note, Peter, that has the greatest influence over our investment decision making. So we look forward to that, although there wasn't one out today because you're out doing media work with clients such as this. So shame on you, Peter, but thanks for doing this podcast.
You're welcome.
But on the basis that you do have that influence over our investment thinking, we have taken a more constructive view on the dollar and a more cautious view on emerging markets. But I think that's where we want to focus the conversation today because, for example, you know, we have seen the Turkish Central Bank behave a little bit more sensibly just earlier in the week. And we've seen a little bit sort of softer data on US inflation, things that don't necessarily support that bearish EM view, dollar bullish view. But before we sort of get into those, that specific conversation, perhaps you want to sort of lay out your framework of why you have this more positive dollar view, bearish emerging market position.
So I think one of the things that investors are getting wrong these days is that they've completely bought into this Larry Summers secular stagnation view about how long-term interest rates are going to be very, very low for a very long period of time. I think the problem with that view is that even if you kind of believe it, interest rates can move around a lot over the course of the business cycle due to cyclical forces. And what we're seeing today is clear evidence that cyclical factors are pushing up the equilibrium rate of interest. So you've got massive amounts of fiscal stimulus. You've got a revival in credit growth. You have, for the first time in a long time, accelerating wage growth, which is putting more money into people's pockets. They're spending that money. The savings rate is quite elevated in the U.S. It's near 7%. It has scope to come down. So there's going to be a lot of additional demand that will emanate from the U.S. over the next a few years. And this will happen at a time when the economy basically is at full employment. And trend growth in the U.S. is probably under 2%. So we're going to get overheating. And that overheating is going to cause the Fed to raise rates much more than what the market currently expects. And given that the Fed is the only game in town, given that other central banks are not raising rates at all, for the most part at least, we're going to see this widening of interest rate differentials in favor of the dollar. The dollar will appreciate, and that will in turn cause all sorts of problems for emerging markets. And those problems will partly be a reflection of the stronger dollar, but they're also going to be a reflection of the fact that we've had 10 years of ultra-low interest rates around the world, and emerging markets have been feasting not just on dollar debt, but they've been issuing local debt like crazy and now have huge amounts of debt that they have to contend with. And when you have that much debt at a time when monetary policy is finally starting to become more restrictive in the US, it's a recipe for all sorts of turmoil in emerging markets.
Okay, well, a fascinating opener there. We'll come back to emerging markets. Perhaps we can come back to the States first and that view, I guess, that the market's a little bit behind where the Fed is actually going to take policy. We look at the data this week. We've had slightly softer numbers on inflation relative to expectations, CPI. And I know you're sort of a big proponent of the housing market and what that can do for an economy, and it's going to be sort of a powerful force for the US economy. And again, that data hasn't necessarily been particularly spectacular. So that, with that in mind, do you think the dollar's sort of ready for a bit of a pause?
It's possible. So we have been flagging a near-term risk that China perhaps might stimulate its economy, that could kind of revive bullish sentiment towards emerging markets. It could sort of spur the expectation of stronger global growth. And typically, when global growth accelerates, the dollar tends to weaken. Now, personally, I think if that were to happen, it wouldn't last very long. I think China is very much limited in what it can do in terms of stimulus, given that it's got this massive overhang of debt. It's got all sorts of imbalances that it needs to contend with. And so doing the traditional credit and fiscal easing is much more tricky this time around. But it's definitely a risk. In terms of the U.S. economy, so you're right, housing has been a little bit on the weak side. I don't think there's much of a mystery as to why that is. Mortgage yields have gone up around 60 basis points this year. Earlier this year, we also saw some tax changes which reduced the cap on interest deductibility for mortgages. And that also has weighed on the housing sector. But ultimately, what matters for housing is there a glut of homes? And the answer is there isn't. The vacancy rate in the housing market is close to a record low. So that's going to support construction. It's going to support prices. And B, are consumers willing to buy homes? And the answer is yes. The affordability of homes, at least measured by how much you have to pay to service a mortgage, is near all-time lows. At the same time, you've got banks that are more than happy to lend because lending standards have been very tight for many years. So I don't think there's really much of a backdrop that makes me think that housing will weaken very much. And that's critical to my view because, as I've often argued, housing is the main channel through which the Fed affects the economy. Yeah, when the Fed raises interest rates, business investment slows a little bit, but most business equipment is relatively short-lived. You know, you buy a computer, it's obsolete in 5 years. Housing isn't short-lived. Housing is very sensitive to changes in interest rates. And so because housing is quite resilient now, and because the way the Fed will be slowing the economy is through the housing markets, the Fed can actually raise rates quite a bit before housing begins to seriously come under pressure. And that in turn means that the Fed probably can raise rates more than what the market is currently assuming.
Okay, well, I mean, I did pick out, I cherry picked a couple of data points in the US that have been less than inspiring. But generally, of course, the US data has been very strong. And if I think about, you know, the ISM number that we've had recently, the JOLTS report, and indeed the wages number that was at a 9-year high, all of that collectively, and yet the dollar's sort of not at, you know, it's all year-to-date high. You know, I'm just sort of wondering whether there's sort of a bit of fatigue, perhaps, in the dollar trade. You know, all of that collectively, the strength of the data, we thought the dollar should be, you know, bursting through new highs.
I think the reason it's not is because interest rate expectations haven't really adjusted that much. So if you look at what the market is pricing, and the market basically expects short-term rates to be up to around 2.25% at the end of this year. The market expects rates to be up to about 2.75% at the end of next year. So it's only two rate hikes that are priced in for next year. And then if you look beyond 2019, the market's actually pricing no rate hikes at all. So the terminal rate based on the overnight index swap curve and other sort of instruments like the Fed funds futures are basically saying that the Fed's not going to be able to raise rates above 3%. If we have at some point over the next 12 months a period in which inflation actually does move higher, not just to 2%, which is where it is now, but to 2.5%. And the Fed is forced to get much more aggressive. You're going to see those interest rate expectations adjust significantly. And at that point, the dollar will start to appreciate more aggressively. And that in turn could create this vicious, or if you'd like to, vicious circle if you're an emerging market, virtuous circle if you're a dollar bull, where a strengthening dollar creates all sorts of problems for emerging markets. That leads to capital outflows from EM back into the US Treasury market, leading to an even stronger dollar and even more EM stress.
Okay, well, if we flip to emerging markets now, and as I said at the top of this conversation, we have seen, you know, notwithstanding sort of the China-related issues, which of course is the hub of emerging markets, but, you know, you have seen the Turkish Central Bank take a more of a sort of orthodox move, moving interest, trying to get positive real rates, taking interest rates much higher than anticipated, and maybe restore some credibility to, you know, an area where there was very little credibility. Now, that's a useful step. But also, sorry to extend the question, you know, the point that the futures curve hasn't anticipated where you think the Fed's going to go, presumably emerging market equities are pricing in a lot of, you know, bad news for the asset class, reflecting sort of some of this dollar appreciation and poor form from central banks. Now, combined with that central bank change and simply the valuations on offer, you know, what do you think about this as an entry point for the asset class?
Well, I mean, certainly EM equities have cheapened, but I would say that they're far from cheap. So we have a valuation measure at BCA that my colleague Arthur Burdakian uses quite frequently. He takes all the EM equity sectors and he takes out the most cheap 20%, takes out the most expensive 20%, sort of looks at the median EM equity sector based on price to earnings, price to book, price to sales, dividend yield, and so on and so forth. So if you look at sort of the median EM sector, it's actually not particularly cheap. The overall index looks quite cheap because there's a lot of financials, there are a lot of kind of deep cyclical companies that really have gotten cheap, but they're cheap for a reason, right? Especially in the case of financials, where there really is a big risk around rising non-performing loans. But for the median EM company, it's cheaper, but it's certainly nowhere close to the levels that have been associated with past bottoms in EM stocks. So from that perspective, there's room for them to decline further. Now, in terms of the steps that emerging markets are taking, I mean, listen, I began my career at the IMF. And one of the things that I did early on in my career, I worked on a lot of these Asian economies that were suffering during the late 1990s because of all the imbalances that have been accumulated. And they did the same thing. They also started to intervene. They raised short-term interest rates, but it was always too little, too late. Once you have accumulated massive amounts of debt that you simply cannot pay back, you can start to follow all the orthodox prescriptions in the world, and usually it's just not going to be enough. At that point, you have to go through the cleansing, you have to go through a big devaluation, you have to let some of that debt default. So I think in the case of Turkey, yes, the central bank is doing some things, not a lot, to be quite honest. It's just not going to be enough. And I think, unfortunately, that's true for other emerging markets as well. It's just not going to be enough, given the imbalances that have been built up over the last decade.
Okay, well, that's been a really helpful insight into the dollar emerging market trade. We actually had Caroline Miller on this very podcast just sort of 5 or 6 weeks ago, explaining why BCA had gone from sort of an overweight position in equities to a neutral position. I know that hasn't changed, but you know, for our listeners, if you could sort of remind us of why you've downgraded, but also why you're not sort of underweight equities as well, because that's important, because equities would still form the biggest part of that sort of balanced portfolios that you construct.
Yeah, so I think, you know, if I was going to use an analogy of where we're in the cycle now, it's probably somewhere in early 1998. So the problems in emerging markets are building, but they haven't reached a crescendo. You know, we haven't seen that sort of washout sell-off that leads to a capitulation in markets. We're going to see more pain. And of course, if you think about 98, this was in the midst of a bull market in U.S. stocks. But there was a point during the summer of 1998 when the S&P fell by 20%. So there's always this risk that problems in emerging markets seem to be irrelevant until they become really, really, really relevant. And at a time when U.S. growth is likely to slow, not because demand is weakening, but because the economy is running out of spare capacity, and we're moving into this more stagflationary environment potentially, that's a time when I think investors need to be a bit more cautious. So why aren't we completely bearish then? Why haven't we downgraded stocks to underweight? Well, the answer is that we're just starting to see this overheating in the U.S. It's probably going to take another couple of years before the U.S. enters a full-blown recession. And typically what happens is that the stock market peaks only about 6 to 12 months before the recession occurs. And that still gives us, I think, another 12 to 18 months of space where the markets can rebound. So what I would expect to happen is, again, very similar to what we saw in 1998. In 1998, long-term capital management imploded. The Fed backed off for a bit. In fact, they cut rates by 50 basis points. And in October, you had a bottom in commodities. You had a bottom in emerging market stocks. You had a bottom in kind of the deep cyclical equity names. And then a blow-off rally began, which took markets, certainly took the U.S. stock market, to new highs. So I think at some point next year, we will see a point where emerging markets have cheapened enough that all of the things that I hate now, I want to start loving again. At some point next year, I'm going to be long cyclicals versus defensives, long EM versus DM, long Europe relative to the US. And of course, people forget this now, but in 1999, Europe massively outperformed the US. So we might get this transition next year. I just don't think we're there now. I think right now the pain in emerging markets will continue and intensify.
Well, just on that point about recession risk, I'd say we have sort of three signals that we look at. You know, the yield curve, the LEI in the global LEI, and then the third one is the Peter Behrens in notes. You know, you telling us when the recession's coming, and the fact that you think it's sort of that distance away is really reassuring. But we also recognise that they can be hard to predict, and you know, post events, you know, it's very obvious to explain why the recession came sooner than anticipated. But I guess here we are with this sort of ongoing trade issues that maybe there's some better news from one day to the next. But generally, you know, you sort of feel as though Trump may be sort of stuck in on both sides, maybe stuck in for quite a ride on this one. You know, do you see that at all bringing about, having the potential to bring about an end of the cycle sort of sooner than anticipated?
I mean, I think if we enter a full-scale trade war that kind of goes beyond the U.S. and China.
What does that look like? Yeah, sorry.
I think what it looks like is sort of this tit-for-tat retaliation that probably goes beyond tariffs. So if we start seeing, you know, China basically close the doors to Apple making sales in China, if we see that sort of blockage, not just of traditional trade, but foreign investment, and the global economy really begins to shut down, yeah, that could trigger a recession. That wouldn't be my base case. I think ultimately what we're going to see is what we've seen already in North America, Mexico sort of agreeing to some concessions. Canada probably will agree to some concessions. And this trade war lingers, but it doesn't reach a scale that really does threaten the global economy. And then if that's the case, it just becomes kind of this usual question of when will financial conditions tighten to a point where recession becomes likely. Right now, I mean, certainly if you buy my view that for cyclical reasons, the neutral rate in the U.S. is much higher than people think, it's going to take a while for interest rates in the U.S. to get into restrictive territory. So monetary policy will remain accommodative probably for the next 18 months, if not more. Fiscal policy obviously will remain accommodative. And so usually, at least almost certainly, you don't have recessions when both fiscal and monetary policy are stimulative. And this, and today, what also helps kind of the U.S. is that the sort of financial vulnerabilities, the imbalances that often exaggerate and exacerbate recessions are broadly missing. So as I said, you know, the housing sector is in reasonably good shape. Vacancies are very low. Household debt is very low. Banks are well capitalized. I think there's some issues around corporate debt, admittedly, but probably they're not as grave as people think. And by the way, we had a dress rehearsal for what a problem in the corporate debt market could look like in 2015. Remember, corporate spreads blew out in 2015. Everyone had kind of anticipated defaults to rise. They never did. So what this tells me is that even in the corporate debt market, things aren't so so treacherous that a small number of rate hikes could cause problems for that sector and generate sort of systemic risks for the broader economy. My guess is that the Fed is just going to be raising rates, and it will take a while to bring rates to a level that does slow the economy to a point where you have a recession. And then from that perspective, I think we do have more running room for risk assets to move up once these issues in emerging markets are ultimately resolved.
Okay, so I mean, sorry to sort of come back to trade. Just, you know, we were sort of anticipating, or the Trump administration has paved the way to put up these 25% tariffs on an additional $200 billion worth of imports. You know, we're all a bit sort of numbed or blinded to big numbers. But for our listeners, you know, is that really, how problematic would that be? And, you know, if China were to respond, I know it can't necessarily respond, it doesn't import $200 billion worth of goods, but it could put up more tariffs on a smaller number of items. You know, would that in itself be something that would be really shock the markets, or are we prepared for that? Or indeed, is it just not a big enough number in terms of global trade?
So I think if we're just talking about the U.S. raising tariffs on China and China raising tariffs in the U.S., you know, that's something that the global economy can cope with. Okay, there are taxes. Okay, we're used to paying taxes. No big deal. If we, however, begin to see China or the U.S., or both perhaps, really gumming up the global supply chain, you know, preventing U.S. companies that have factories in China from accessing the goods that are produced in those factories, and so the supply chain globally begins to malfunction, that would be a problem. I don't think we're going to see that because largely if China were to go down that route, it would be hurting itself. But that's definitely a risk. Another risk is how China retaliates. So right now, China is threatening to increase tariffs on U.S. goods coming into China. But what they could do, and I think to some extent they're already doing that, is retaliating by letting their currency weaken. And the risk, I think, is that this begins to sort of spiral out of control, that as the Chinese currency comes down, this generates capital outflows out of China, leading to further currency weakness. And if the RMB does weaken a lot, that would be quite disruptive to the rest of the world. Certainly, we saw a taste of that in 2015 when China did this mini devaluation. If we have something similar to that, then there could be adverse effects on global growth. Certainly, emerging markets would be adversely affected by weaker RMB because, it would deprive other emerging markets that compete with China of competitiveness. And two, if the Chinese currency falls, becomes more expensive for Chinese companies to import raw materials, and that reduces commodity prices, which also hurts emerging markets.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Peter, for all your contribution. I guess if we're just going to tie round this conversation out, I guess we don't have time to go into too much detail, but it's very clear that you know, you're positive on the dollar and more cautious on emerging markets. I don't know if there's any other sort of standout trades that are out there in your eyes, sort of on the next sort of six to 12 month view that you may be able to rationalize for us.
Yeah, so I think our equity views are fairly clear. We would prefer EM. We would prefer developed markets over emerging markets. We would prefer the U.S. over Europe. We would prefer defensive equity sectors over cyclicals. I think where we struggle a little bit is on the bond view. Because as I said before, the Fed is probably going to be behind the curve. We're probably going to get more inflation than the market expects. All things equal, obviously, that's bad for bonds. But at the same time, if we have EM stress, especially in the near term, and the dollar is appreciating and capital is flowing into the U.S. because the U.S. is being seen as a safe haven market, well, treasury yields are likely to go down in the near term. So I think what the way we kind of reconcile that is by thinking about different horizons. Longer term, we're bearish bonds. Near term, we're more constructive.
Okay, well, as I said, Peter, thanks so much for sharing all of those thoughts. It's been really, really useful. I guess we'll allow you to get back to Montreal and start writing another note because we've missed it this week. to our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, on iTunes, SoundCloud, whatever platform you listen to our podcast from. But until next time, many thanks for listening.
Thank you.